Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, JPMorgan Chase, one of the largest banks in the United States, announced losses of over $2 billion in the derivatives market. Yesterday, President Obama said JPMorgan Chase is, quote, one of the best managed banks there is. He called JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon one of the smartest bankers we got. We don't know all the details. It's going to be investigated. But this is why we passed Wall Street reform. The New York Times reports that Jamie Dimon has been on a mission to water down and repeal financial reform. He opposes the so-called Volcker Rule, which would prevent banks with government-guaranteed deposits from engaging in proprietary trading, basically speculating with depositors' money. In 2011, JPMorgan Chase spent $7.6 million to lobby with 13 lobbying firms. So is this an anomaly, or are these problems as systemic as they were in 2008? Has anything changed since the economic crisis hit? In his new book, Inequality and Instability, economist and author James Galbraith argues that in a deep sense, inequality was at the heart of the financial crisis. The crisis was about the terms of credit between the wealthy and everyone else as mediated by mortgage companies, banks, rating agencies, investment banks, government-sponsored enterprises, and the derivatives market. James Galbraith teaches economics at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He also directs the university's Inequality Project. Professor Galbraith's latest book is Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the crisis. And he joins us on the line from Austin, Texas. Hi, Professor Galbraith. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. So why don't we start off by talking about the big news in the economy right now. What did you make of the announcement of JPMorgan Chase announcing losses of over $2 billion in the derivatives market? What happened here?
Well, I don't think we know for sure the details of the trade. Obviously, they had an operation in London, which had positions that they could not unwind easily. They ended up, in some sense, stepping on their shoelaces and taking a big loss.
And so what does this tell us about where we are right now? Is this an anomaly, or are these problems as systemic as they were in 2008?
Well, this is not 2008, but it does tell us that some of the large banks don't have the kinds of controls that they would like to have the players that they have in their offices. That seems to be pretty clear.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? I mean, what we're hearing from President Obama is JPMorgan Chase is, quote, one of the best managed banks there is. He called CEO Jamie Dimon one of the smartest bankers we got. We don't know all the details. It's going to be investigated. But this is why we passed Wall Street reform. What did you think about that statement?
I don't think that anything that's happened contradicts what the president said. I think that in the nature of a very large bank, the people who are carrying out some of these trades are going to have positions that their managers can't possibly be entirely on top of. And so it's a systemic issue. In this particular case, it was JPMorgan that got bit.
And three of their financial officers have stepped down so far. One of their financial officers made about $14 million a year, Ina Drew, JPMorgan veteran who headed the chief investment office and who departed on Monday.
Well, the compensation of the officers of large banks is a function of how big those banks are and how much money they have under management, how much money they have at risk. If you want to have banks with less well-paid officers than what you need to have is smaller banks. Mm. That's the essential issue. I think there's a case to be made for having smaller banks, that the internal controls would be easier to supervise, and regulators' job would be easier, and the banks themselves would be more focused on, let's say, the regions and the smaller enterprises in those regions than the mega banks that we have presently are.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because we don't really hear much about the size of banks now. For years, of course, the line was too big to fail, and now so many of these banks are even bigger than they were when they were too big to fail. So what does that mean exactly? And could just sort of paint us a picture of where we really are right now with these huge banks?
Well, let's put it this way. If you go look over the U.S. economy over the sweep of, let's say, 50 years, in the 1960s and 1970s, it was the large industrial corporations that dominated the scene, and they had substantially internal sources of finance. They controlled their own research, their own production lines. They were empires unto themselves. Today, it's the big banks. They have enormous sway over economic activity as a whole, and there's just a handful of them that are exercising powers that are truly extraordinary for actors that are nominally in the private sector. And they are powerful enough so that they effectively can command the backstop of the government for whatever risks they choose to assume or whatever ill events may come their way. So we are looking at an institution, at a world in which transparently the large banks, both here and in Europe, are in the driver's seat. It's not only that they can tell governments what to do, they can also offer employment to high government officials when they leave their jobs. And so there is a very, very close relationship between these two sectors, between the public sector and the financial sector, that is far tighter and more powerful than was the case 40 or 50 years ago.
And what does that tell us about where we might be going based on all of the historical research you've done, especially when you look at JPMorgan Chase? Because according to First Street Research, 12 of the 14 in-house lobbyists for JP are former congressional and federal staffers. 48 lobbyists are representing the bank. They spent $7.6 million on lobbying last year. So what does that mean for the future of regulation and just where we're going with the economy?
Well, lobbying is one piece of it, but the reality is that these are institutions that have the rest of us over a barrel. They get into trouble, even though we have sworn on stacks of Bibles and the Dodd-Frank law that we will not bail them out. Once we are faced with a panicky situation, it's extremely difficult to imagine that we won't. And to the extent that they find certain regulatory interventions unacceptable, it's not just that they can hire former officials to lobby for them. They can also give the highest level of former officialdom high-paid executive jobs, which is something that people currently working in this line of policy in the government are perfectly well aware of. So, again, it's a problem with very hefty ramifications for the way we think of how the economy and the society are governed.
And this goes to one of the main points you make in your book, and that is rising income inequality is driven by the movement of the stock market. And in your book, you really look at the close relationship between the stock market and inequality.
It's perfectly clear in U.S. data that the movement of a measurement of income inequality is very, very closely associated with the movement of capital asset prices, stock prices, and people who have leveraged positions on capital asset prices. And what's happening is that those people are reporting taxable income and capital gains, stock options realizations, and earnings from initial public offerings and things of that nature that are closely tied to the ups and downs of the financial and capital asset markets. So it's really just saying that the two phenomena are the same thing, and one is a measure of the other.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because we've done so many shows about income inequality and, you know, how we got here and where we're going, but we haven't spent much time talking about income inequality and how it connects to the stock market.
Well, let's just take the example that I offer in the book, which is a measurement of income inequality taken across the counties of the United States, which is obviously not the whole of income inequality, but it captures a major element of what happened and what continues to happen as economic conditions evolve. If you look at the period from the early 1990s to 2000, and you see an enormous rise in income inequality, which peaks in 2000, and it coincides exactly both in terms of when it peaks and how much it falls afterwards, and in terms of the proportional rise and fall to the movement of the NASDAQ stock market index. So that tells you something that makes you strongly suspect that there's a relationship between these two things. But then there's the fact that the NASDAQ is the technology-heavy stock index, and so you can ask, well, where exactly were these incomes booked, and how much do the incomes in New York and Silicon Valley actually affect the movement of inequality? So we did that experiment, and basically what we did was to say, let's suppose that you took out the county of New York, New York, Manhattan, and instead of its actual incomes, you substitute a sort of a dummy figure, let the income rise at the average rate for the country as a whole. How much less would total inequality have risen? The answer is maybe 30% less than it actually was at the peak. And then if you take out four more counties, remember there are 3,150 counties in the United States, so this is just a minute geographic area, and the four are Santa Clara, San Mateo, San Francisco, and King County, Washington. You take out those four plus New York, New York, and half of the rise of inequality went away. Take out the top 15, and all of the rise of inequality between counties goes away. So that what that tells you is that the what we observe and measure as rising income inequality is very heavily incomes that are booked in very few places, which are obviously known to us as the centers of finance and of information technology in this particular period. The pattern then changes a bit as you move into the 2000s. In 2003, 2004, 2005, it's the area around Washington, D.C. that has the largest income gains. And then at the peak of the housing bubble, it's places in Southern California and Southern Florida. It's exactly what you'd expect.
Gillian Tett writes in the Financial Times about your book, and the lead title of her article is "It's All Downhill for U.S. Equality." She says, some of the arguments in your book will not convince some economists, let alone bankers. But if nothing else, Galbraith's work raises an intriguing question. If the finance sector shrinks in the coming years, could the inequality trend ease? She says it's hard to imagine right now, given the degree to which Wall Street power still seems entrenched.
Well, I think on the measures that I'm using, that we saw a peak of income inequality around the year 2000, which is already 12 years ago, and a kind of a sawtooth pattern in the years since. So there is, and as I have to live by my own correlations, if I argue that the income inequality closely tracks the stock market, and we discover that the stock market, in fact, hasn't risen in 12 years, then we're going to find that income inequality also hasn't risen in 12 years, at least not materially. And I think that's a fact. And I think that when we get, as we get the corroborating data from the census, that will be substantially, it is substantially corroborated. So is that to say that there is, that the problem has gone away? Well, the levels are still very high. And it's really to say that in my work, income inequality is not, my objective is not to hold it up as something to be, attacked or vilified. It's to something that is a fact of our social existence, and the important thing is to measure it carefully and correctly.
Well, and it's also a fact that according to the latest census numbers, almost half of the country is either living in poverty or is about to be there, really, really struggling. So, when you take a look at your data and then apply that to what's happening on the ground, how do you make sense of where we are right now?
Well, I think if one wants to, and it's a very important task to understand what's happening to the broader population, you have to move beyond the data on income, the data on wages, and you have to understand what's happening to people's asset positions, to their security.
Right.
These are really the things that affect the American middle class most profoundly. And what's happened to the value of their houses? A substantial majority of the American population lives in their own homes and was counting on some of that home equity as a cushion for later life, and that's a huge problem for those people. what's happened to their retirement security, and what may happen if the consensus in Washington moves to further cuts of Medicare and cuts in Social Security, which I think is a serious danger moving forward. So one of the things that, I mean, and this goes beyond what I am attempting to do in this particular book, but one of the things that I think is just most important for people to understand is that it is really quite inexpensive for the public to provide social insurance for itself, for the community at large. And cutting back on that is a false economy. It's something which is advantageous to certain players. It's advantageous to fund managers and insurance companies and people who would take over part of those markets as the public sector is squeezed out of them. It's not advantageous to the population at large.
We're speaking with James Galbraith about his new book, Inequality and Instability. And in the book, he argues that income inequality is directly tied to financial events. Over the last 30 years, inequality has been rising in roughly similar ways around the world since 1980. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this? What questions do you have about inequality, how we got here, and where we're going? And if you have any questions for Professor Galbraith about what happened with J.P. Morgan Chase, or just the latest news on the economy, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a question from Ruby, who says, I read that there were a number, maybe 20 to 30 government regulators embedded into J.P. Morgan Chase's operations, and when they saw trouble, they were disregarded. Professor Galbraith, do you know anything about this?
It is quite usual for government regulators to be embedded in the operations of large banks, but I don't know the details of what they might have reported on this particular position.
And what does that mean when you say that they're regularly embedded in the company's operations?
Well, these are depository institutions. They are subject to a federal regulation, and you need to have people on site monitoring what the banks are doing. And that is something that the federal government actually does.
And Ruby also says, is one answer for prevention enforcing the rules that are already in place, or do we need more regulations?
Hard for me to apply to give an answer that would apply to this particular case because I don't know the details.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Ruby. So why don't you also talk a little bit about the argument you make about inequality rising in similar ways around the world since 1980?
Well, one of the things that has hampered academic research in this area has been that the data gathered, measurements taken over time, around the world have been rather sparse and often done by different people and different entities for different purposes, so not easy to compare. And one of the things that I present in the book is a body of measures that are, generally speaking, comparable and that fill in the historical record so that one can look for patterns around the world and sort of ask, why is this happening? What is happening? And why is it happening? There's a lot of guessing or hypothesis making, to use a fancy term in the academic literature, about the effect of technology or trade. Very hard to evaluate those arguments unless you have really good data of the right type. And I think that the evidence that I present in the book is good data of the right type. And what it shows is that there's a common pattern in the movement of inequality around the world from the early 70s on through the 80s. It's basically a pattern which involves some declining inequality through the 1970s, a huge turnaround in 1980, and then a big increase that goes on for 20 years from 1980 to 2000. And what's involved there? The debt crisis in Latin America, the collapse of the communist regimes in Central Europe and the Soviet Union, and finally the rising inequality in Asia leading up to the Asian crisis of 1997. So we have waves of rising inequality that are closely associated with financial transformations around the world. It seems to me that's an important finding because it tells you that the movement of inequality is not something that individual governments decide upon, or that's a consequence of their local policies. It's the result of large-scale financial forces, which emanated in this period largely from the United States, from New York, and from London.
Well, let's take a few callers before we go to break. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Does the book go into like what the quantification is of the leverage of stock market gains, and what is the mechanism? Are you talking about options? Are you talking about credit default swaps? And you know, if you can go into, or are you talking about IPOs? You know, getting early, like you know, you got the Facebook IPO coming up. I guess Morgan Stanley's doing that one, so the bankers there are going to make a killing. What's the leverage, and what's the mechanism of the leverage? Thanks.
Well, that's a very good question, which I cannot answer based on the evidence that I have in this particular section of the book. It's a very what I present is a very simple argument about the movement of inequality as recorded in tax records, which would be coming from all of the sources that you've just described. On the other hand, the movement of reported valuations in the stock market. So you've got that basic correlation, which is very, very tight. And then you have the fact that you can track where the incomes are reported, and that tells you quite immediately that we're talking about the financial sector and the technology sector, which, again, is no surprise once you think about it. It just tells you that when people speak of the top one-tenth of 1%, this is not some generic group of people. It's a very specific set of activities and very specific set of places that are involved.
Right, and many of them are in our own backyard.
Well, of course.
Right. All right, well, thank you for calling, Bill, and we've got time for Jeff in Palo Alto. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, I've heard some authors suggest that if the top marginal tax rate is maintained above 50%, that helps reduce income inequality because business executives are more inclined to leave the money in the business and let the business grow as opposed to taking it out as personal income and then going and gambling with it in the markets.
It's an excellent question, and I think that one of the effects of the 1986 tax reform, which lowered marginal rates and expanded the base at the top, was in fact to encourage people who control businesses to pay themselves more, to take the money out, and a lot of it ended up in fancy housing, and a lot of it ended up back in the financial markets. If you could restore the high marginal rates, would you have a converse effect? Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you would end up with the money back in the business, and of course, the business would then use the money under the direction of the same people. So it's not entirely clear to me that you are making as big a social change as you might think just from the dramatic change in the tax rates. But it would certainly change the form with which people who controlled these resources actually used them. I think the evidence is that when we made those changes in 81, 80, and 86, that it did have the kind of effect I just described.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Jeff. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with James Galbraith, Inequality and Instability. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, joining Rose Aguilar here in the studio, asking for your support in this hour of your call. We have a goal. 20 calls or clicks, people coming forward and saying, yes, I appreciate independent, thoughtful radio like I get on your call every day of the week and throughout the schedule on KALW. Show your support right now, and if we can make it to that 20-call goal, two generous listeners, Patricia Culp and Jenny Chu, have put up $600 of their money. They've said, we want to provide this support to challenge other listeners to get involved. 800-525-9917. Or KALW.org.
800-525-9917 or online KALW.org. You can, for a
$120 contribution,
thank you, Matt.
We will send you James Galbraith's book, Inequality and instability.
Inequality and instability, and your contribution will be doubled. Thank you so much. 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org. I've got a number of emails I'm going to go to in just a couple minutes. These economy shows are really important just to open up the lines to say, hey, there's a lot going on in the news. You have a lot of questions. We're going to take them, and our guests will answer them to the best of their ability. That's the kind of radio and media that we need. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. Every day of the week on Your Call, it's about participation. And that means it's not just about you calling. It's not just about you sending emails. It's part about you making this media. And we think that if we're going to have a functioning democracy, we've got to get involved. If we're going to have a more just economy, we have to be aware and into it, asking questions, trying to make change on the ground. Your call of support right now at 800-525-9917 or online at klw.org will help make that happen. Rose, we have a great gift at our basic membership rate. That's the DVD of Cornel West and Tavis Smiley at the Paramount a couple of weeks ago, including Rose's great introduction and Q&A afterwards. Your support at the basic membership rate will get you that DVD. We're happy to share the information, share the ideas, keep the conversation going.
800-525-9917. A room full of volunteers are ready to take your calls. If you can afford a dollar a day, you can become a Your Call Insider.
Oh, that's cool.
Come to the station, hang out, watch the show, and tell us what you like and what shows you'd like us to do in the future. 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org. And if you can afford that dollar a day, it will be doubled. 800-525-9917. Keep independent radio going strong.
800-525-9917. We have a goal, 20 calls, 20 clicks at any amount. If we make it there, we get that additional $600. 800-525-9917. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. You can find more information about our show, yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for past shows there and drop us an email if you've got guest ideas or a show idea. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Dr. John McDougall about our current health crisis. This will be an important one. And then on Thursday, we'll be doing a show about a documentary called Crime After Crime. It's about women serving time for killing their abusive partners. Heavy topic, really important information. Today, we are having a conversation with James Galbraith. He teaches economics at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He directs the university's Inequality Project. His latest book is Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the crisis. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments for Professor Galbraith about his findings about inequality and instability, how we got here, where we're going, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We do these economy shows every Tuesday to find out what's happening, find out about the latest research, and also just to open the lines to take your questions about what we're currently facing and where we're going. You can also post a comment to yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to tell Professor Galbraith that I was a great admirer of him, as I was of his father. And I remember the article that he wrote quite a long time ago, and that was in the Chronicle, about the national debt. I can't remember what, you know, exactly what he said, but he said that, you know, that it was kind of smoke and mirrors, that we didn't have to worry about the national debt, that, you know, that we could print more money, and that we've always had a national debt, and that it wasn't anything to worry about. I think I've got it right. And that I was so impressed with this that I cut it out and sent it to President Obama. And I just wanted him, you know, to thank him for his views on the economy.
Well, thank you very much for that, and for that highly futile gesture.
Well, Professor Galbraith, your piece, I think you also wrote a similar one in The Nation, and it was passed around all over the place. I saw it on Facebook many times. Is that right?
Glad to hear it. Yeah, I've written about this many times.
Yeah, so where are you right now on debt? It's interesting to see the conversation switch from debt to inequality, thanks largely in part because of the Occupy movement.
Well, I think let's distinguish between the debt held by private individuals and households, the debt held by the debt of the government of the United States. They're two very different things. Private households have to have incomes to service their debts. And when they can't service them, they're going to default, and they're going to also try to pay down their debts with the income that they have available, and that's going to contract economic activity. We're seeing that everywhere. That's the process called deleveraging, and it is the fundamental source of economic stagnation right now. The government debt is in the case of the United States or a country like Japan or Britain, which controls its own currency, is the consequence of, straightforwardly, of the difference between what the government has to spend and what it takes in tax revenues, given the weakness of the private economy. So that, yes, the government debt goes up in bad times. That is because private economic activity is way down. This is something that actually works to stabilize the economy, because when the government spends more than takes in taxes, the private sector, the mirror image in an accounting sense, has more income, loses less income to taxes than it does in better times. And so overall, the effect of this is kind of a balance wheel effect, that the government tends to stabilize private activity. This is a major reason why the banking debacle and the private debt debacle that started 4 years ago has not led to an exact replay of the Great Depression of the 1930s. Back in those days, there was no stabilizing public sector. And when the private sector collapsed, so did total output by about 30%. The fall this time has been bad, but it hasn't been nearly as bad as that. So that just seems to me to be a statement of the realities that we face. Is it possible to have a public debt problem? Sure. It's possible if you're in the situation that many countries in Europe are in, where you can't effectively finance the existing public sector, and nobody's willing to make the resources available to you to do that. And that's a tragedy which is being played out before our eyes in Europe at the moment.
Well, thank you again for the call, Nancy. And we have a question about organizing and bargaining power. Can you talk a little bit about how the loss of bargaining power has contributed to wages? And just reading your book, it reminded me of a column I recently read in the Washington Post by Harold Meyerson. And he took a look, and I'll get these numbers in a minute, but he took a look at how jobs in the auto factories, for example, that used to pay, say, $28 an hour are now paying $15 an hour. At a new high-tech locomotive plant in Muncie, Indiana, Caterpillar is hiring workers at about $12 an hour. These are highly skilled jobs. That's $24,000 a year. And the main argument is that American workers have lost all of their bargaining power, and therefore employers can blow them off. And judging by the data, that's exactly what they're doing. What are your thoughts on that argument?
Well, I think that argument's substantially correct. Two things have happened. One, beginning in the early 1980s, there was a massive blow to the viability of American industry, and that fed back directly on employment and on unionization. So in this particular period, the first 4 years of the Reagan administration, the union movement suffered a fall from which it has not recovered. And in the manufacturing sector, as much as we may have some sectors, some parts of manufacturing where we're going to retain an important presence in world markets, the reality is that employment is not going to recover on a sustained basis. We are going to continue to trade for much cheaper manufactured goods coming from low-wage countries. So that is a fact that we have to deal with. The other side of the coin, if there is another side of it, is that the number of jobs involved here in relation to all jobs in the United States is very small. Manufacturing now is about 11 million jobs in total, and 8% of total employment. And the amount of that actually is, let's say, routine line manufacturing is, probably half or so of that 11 million. So most of us are off doing something else, and that is a permanent feature going forward. Most of us are working in the services sector in one capacity or another, and the problem for service jobs is, what are the basic standards for wages, and what kind of security do people have as they round out their working lives? What kind of health care coverage do they have? How decent is the retirement that they can look forward to? And those are issues that we can deal with, but we can only deal with them as a large community. It is something where it's very, very hard for all the small shops that come and go for workers to organize and retain strong self-protections. But we can do so as a large community. We can do so as a country. And that's where it seems to me we need to focus our efforts.
Well, and on the subject of jobs, Bloomberg reports that most of the jobs being created are in low-wage sectors. Even highly skilled jobs, like we just mentioned, are paying less than about $20 an hour. And last year, in this Harold Meyerson piece, he quoted JPMorgan Chase Chief Investment Officer Michael Sembalist. Last year, in a newsletter to investors, he wrote, U.S. labor compensation is now at a 50-year low relative to both company sales and U.S. GDP. So what does this mean for where we're going if people are taking highly skilled jobs with a company like Caterpillar for $12 an hour with no benefits?
Well, I think where we're going will be a matter of what sort of society we design for ourselves going forward. And there, to me, in some ways, the crucial issues, as I said before, are matters like retirement security, health care, the availability of affordable education, environmental services, local public services, the availability and quality of your police, your fire, your parks and libraries, your water and sewer, all of these things which form the warp and woof of community life are provided largely outside the wage structure. That is to say, people, of course, are paid for doing those jobs, but the services that they provide come to the community through other channels. I would say that that's where you have the ability to improve things. And that's where the battlegrounds are. The true battleground going forward that is going to affect most people's lives is how severely Social Security and Medicare get cut in what I'm sure is a coming wave of deficit and debt hysteria that will envelop us after the election. It seems to me people should be prepared for that and prepared to say that it is quite possible for the United States to continue to provide its working population with health and retirement security. We should do so, and we should defend those programs.
We're speaking with James Galbraith, author of Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the crisis hit. And if you have any questions about income inequality directly tied to financial events over the last 30 years, how we got here, where we're going, if you've got any questions about the latest economic news you've been hearing, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you work in the financial sector, where do you think we're going? And if you've been hit by this crisis, what sort of changes have you seen over the past 5 or so years? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Kenneth in San Rafael. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi. Hi, Professor Galbraith, and thank you and your dad for all the work you've done for this country. My question is, it's basically simple. If we raise taxes on the higher income bracket and then target those taxes to go for three basic things, go for health care, go for education, and go for transportation, we automatically raise the lower half of our economy automatically. If the person who's got a 9-to-5 job and makes $15 an hour and his kid can go to school from K to graduate school paid for by the government, you've raised his wages. If the government pays for universal health care insurance, you've raised the bottom half again without dramatically altering the economy in any other way, and causes more people to get educated, gets more things done, and eventually, and graces the GDP the gross national product tremendously. It's a no-brainer kind of solution, really.
Professor Galbraith?
I think the thrust of the question is pretty much dead on, that you have a core of, let's say, services and investments that you make in the community that are going to lay the foundation for what you can do and how well people can live later in their lives. And that's where we ought to be putting our energy. The one thing I would just stress here or suggest here is that we should separate the question of what the public should be doing from the question of how it's paid for and what the tax rates actually are at any given time. It may well be a good idea to redesign the tax code so that it has a better regulating effect on the inequality of income, so that it moderates those inequalities, so that it encourages wealthy people who've accumulated over time to make charitable donations and to fund universities and hospitals. And this is another way of getting funds back into those sectors that I think is a very important piece of our existing social structure. It may be useful to strengthen the way the tax code works on those incentives. But it's not necessary to have dollars flowing into the government on a one-to-one correspondence with what they flow out as expenditures. That is actually something, the relationship between what the government takes in taxes and what it pays out in expenditures is something actually that we can't control. And we need to get used to the fact that given where the United States sits in the world economy, there are forces that affect us, how many U.S. Treasury bonds the rest of the world wants to hold, that are going to determine the gap, the budget deficit, if you like. We should take a somewhat relaxed attitude toward that and instead focus on the problems that we actually have, which are, again, the decay in our infrastructure, the stress on our education systems, energy, the environment, employment, the foreclosure problem. If we deal with those issues, what we'll basically be doing is increasing some types of public spending and reducing expenditures on unemployment insurance, on various forms of welfare, disability, and so forth that people won't need because they'll be back at work.
Well, what do you think about the tax conversation we're having or maybe aren't having in this country? We had a paramedic on a couple weeks ago who works with the fire department in San Francisco, and he was just talking about how the budget cuts are affecting his ability to do his job. He said he gets really irritated when he hears the term budget deficit. He thinks it needs to be referred to as a revenue deficit. So, I mean, there's so much to talk about here when you're talking about taxes at the local, the state, and the national level. But even, you know, at the local level, groups argue that companies like Bank of America don't pay local taxes. And then there have been so many articles about the multinationals that don't pay taxes at the corporate level. So how would you reform the corporate tax system, and do you support a financial transaction tax?
Okay, let me come at that from the other end. I think the crucial issue here is how do we support local public services, such as your correspondent just described. It's clear that we have put them on the front line of dealing with the recession. Mm-hmm. That they get cut because they depend upon local tax revenues, and when they don't come in, they're subject to a balanced budget constraint. They have to be cut, unless the federal government comes to the rescue, which it did only for a little while. So that's an issue that we need to address. We need to have those services. They should be sustained as they are required and not simply on the basis of what the economic conditions are at a particular moment. Now, on the tax questions, I think, again, one needs a tax system that provides, that moderates the inequality of incomes, and that provides strong incentives to get private funds back into circulation, including through the nonprofit sector. The financial transaction tax would be useful for some purposes. It is, I think, its virtues are overstated in some cases by its advocates. It would, since this is a tax per transaction, it would usefully discourage things like high-frequency trading, since every single one of those trades would then be taxed, and that would become kind of prohibitive. Then you have to ask, can you enforce that tax on a computer program that can migrate to an untaxed jurisdiction? Not entirely clear, but it would be worth a try. I'm inclined to think that if what you want to do is to moderate accumulations, then maybe less preferential treatment of capital gains and a stronger tax on gifts and estates that, again, incentivizes philanthropy is a more effective way to handle that problem. But I understand the motivation behind the financial transactions tax. I do think that the problem of an oversized and in many ways predatory financial sector, which is not serving public purpose, needs to be dealt with by regulatory action. That fundamentally one has to make a decision to downsize the sector. And that would be a useful thing to do because the sector imposes, at this stage, a large fixed cost on everybody in the economy, and it is basically taking away activity from that would otherwise flow to businesses that employ people.
We have a related question from Celine in Capitola. She says, Professor Galbraith, what, if anything, is the most persuasive argument for convincing the wealthy to pay a fairer share of taxes?
That's a hard argument to make, but I think what one should say to one's wealthy friends is that it's impossible to live entirely apart from the society that you are a member of, and you can't cut yourself off. You can't provide all of your own security. You can't provide all of your own services. We're all much better if we work together in a community, and that means that there needs to be a balance between the public and the private spheres. And I think most wealthy people in this country actually understand that. I think the arguments for unlimited gains and for completely abolishing taxes on accumulations, on wealth, on the high incomes, come from a very small sector of people who have who are obviously very highly motivated and have a strong capacity to intervene in the political system, but don't represent the views of most wealthy citizens in the United States.
All right, thanks for the question, Celine. And we've got just about 3 minutes left with Professor Galbraith. So if you have any last-minute questions, you can give us a call now, 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email, and we have just a couple minutes to get on the air, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have a question from Bob in Watsonville who wants your overall assessment of President Obama. What do you think about where he is right now and how he's dealt with the economy?
Well, since we're in an election year, I have to ask, compared to whom? But having said that, I think the administration could and should have acted more forcefully on the economy early in its tenure, more forcefully on the financial system, and that we would be in a stronger place today.
Ooh, sorry about that. I think that's on our end. We're trying to fix that. Professor Galbraith, are you still with us?
I'm here.
Okay. Sorry, we're just getting a lot of static on the line there. Let's just try to fix that, and we'll see if we can get him back. We have just about a minute and a half left with Professor Galbraith, talking to him about his book, Inequality and Instability. I'm glad that happened at the very end of the show. We actually only have about a minute left. Can we try and see if it might work again? I think we lost him. Well, we're actually at the end of the show. So, Professor Galbraith, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking with Professor Galbraith. Sorry about that, but we only had about a minute left, talking about Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis. And thank you so much, Professor Galbraith, for joining us. And it's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and thanks for listening. And it's live radio. Sometimes that happens. And luckily, it only happened with a minute left. So sorry about that. I'm just taking a couple minutes to ask you to support local independent radio and to support these kinds of conversations where we bring on economists, professors like James Galbraith, and open the lines to say, look, so much is going on with the economy. Things are changing quickly. Where are we going? That's the million-dollar question here. Open the lines to take your questions about what we're facing. We need this kind of independent radio to take a look at history. How did we get here? How is this connected to the stock market, as Professor Galbraith argues? That's the kind of radio that we do on a regular basis. Join us to continue this. 800-525-9917. For $120, we will send you Professor Galbraith's book about inequality and instability. 800-525-9917. You can also go online to kalw.org.
800-525-9917 or kalw.org. We're asking you to participate. The reason that we open the lines on your call is because some of the best questions come from our listeners. We know we have intelligent, connected people, folks who have experiences that they want to bring to the table that make this a richer conversation. And right now, we're asking you to keep those lines open. We have a goal during this hour of 20 calls and clicks. We have two listeners, Patricia Culp and Jenny Chu, people just like you who listen to KALW, value what they hear, and have put their support forward to challenge you. If we can make it to that 20 call or click goal in the next 3 minutes, we will have $600 additional dollars to support your call and KALW. Let's make it happen. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org.
800-525-9917. We've got a couple lines open in the volunteer room. $120, we'll send you Professor Galbraith's book. At the $50 level, we'll send you a DVD of the conversation between Cornel West and Tavis Smiley. If you can afford a dollar a day, you can become an Your Call Insider. Come to the station, check out the show, meet all of us, and let us know what you like about the show and what we can do better. 800-525-9917. We cannot do this without you. 100% of your call is funded by you. We need to keep these conversations continuing, to bring on these economists, to ask these questions about what's really happening. It'll never get old, Matt. How did we get here and where are we going?
We have to keep asking those questions. That's where we are as human beings, as citizens in a democracy. And, you know, James Galbraith talking about the fact that, you know, the stock market going up can mean inequality rises right along with it. So often the Dow Jones is treated as the measure of the health of our economy. Conversations here on Your Call put the lie to some of those truisms. Bring real information forward and let you decide and participate. Now show your support, just as Uday Chandra Karoti did in San Jose, a new member. Thank you so much, Uday. Richard Odgers in Mill Valley, longtime supporter of KALW. Richard, thank you for contributing at KALW.org.
800-525-9917 or online KALW.org. This is a collective effort.
We cannot do this without you.
At whatever level you're comfortable with, $50 will send you the Cornell West Tavis Smiley DVD, $120 will send you the Inequality and Instability book. If you can afford a dollar a day and become a Your Call Insider, you will keep us going strong. 800-525-9917. We're independent. We're local. That's how we want to keep it. We cannot do this without your support. 800-525-9917. And I think Doug has an open line. Make his phone ring. He's here every day. He comes in at about 6 or 6:30 in the morning. Because they also value local independent radio. 800-525-9917.
Do not let this opportunity go by. We have great thank you gifts. And most importantly, we have a challenge to get to 20 calls or clicks. 20 people who believe in a show like Your Call, who understand it only happens with a station that's listener-supported right here in the Bay Area. 800-525-9917. Whether you pledge $25, $100, $300 at any level, your support makes a huge difference to this station and helps us meet the challenge put forward by Patricia Culp and Jenny Chu. Thanks to them, and we will thank you as well. 800-525-9917.
And your contribution up to $600 will be matched. Now is a really good time to call. We need 20 calls in the next 10 seconds. 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org. 800-525-9917.
Thanks
for supporting us.
And listening to KALW San Francisco.